This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Last week we talked about the Egel Hazov and a few other examples of what went wrong, in the sense that we looked at situations where the people concerned could hardly have been blamed for reacting in the ways that they did, because they had tremendous difficulties with principles with which they were expected to accept. In the case of the golden calf, they saw with Nevuah, they saw with prophecy that Moshe was dead. In the case of the conquest of Eretz Yisrael, the spies went into Eretz Yisrael and found that it was so powerful, Canaan was so powerful that there was no way that they could conquer it. And they must have said to themselves that God wouldn't have allowed spies to go in if it wasn't their function to test out the strength of the land, and they came back feeling the land was too strong. Could they be blamed for advising people to be cautious and for feeling a little negative about going into the land altogether? The case of Shaul HaMelech, where Shmuel HaNovi says to him, before you start fighting the Plishtim, I'll be there in 7 days' time, and we'll bring a korban, and then we'll go ahead and fight. And he waits and waits and waits, and he's deserted, he's hardly got anything left, and the Plishtim are getting stronger and stronger. Can one blame him for, at the last minute, making the korban himself and going ahead? And we talked about the concept of, what do we call this in English? Steadfastness of opinion. Is it steadfastness? Steadfastness of mind. Tkifus hadas. That there are certain times when one's knowledge is not to be shaken by questions, no matter how serious, how deep, how profound those questions are. Questions don't have to introduce doubts into everything. There are certain things that the human being can know which are beyond doubt. And you can have questions on them, and the questions one day need to be answered, but one stores the questions in a separate part of one's mind. The questions do not dilute the total confidence that one has in the belief of that particular concept. And so, for example, we said that Klal Yisrael knew that Moshe was a Novi Emes, that he was a true prophet, and that every word that he said would come true. And if he said, I'll be back in 40 days, he's going to be back in 40 days, and they should have waited. And Shmuel told Shaul, I'll be there in 7 days, he should have waited, no matter what the other circumstances. All the questions, all the difficulties, although with one's own vision, with one's own senses, if one looks at the situation, it looks that there's no way that one can fulfill the word of the prophet. That's just too bad. That's the word of the prophet, and one has to wait. And likewise with the spies, they were promised that they were going to conquer the land. It looks impossible. Okay, so it looks impossible. It looks impossible to cross the Red Sea as well, but it was done. We also looked at the examples of the Gemara and Bava Metzia, where the argument was taking place and the Baskol interfered, and they were sufficiently confident in their own opinions, although the Baskol told them that they were wrong, to be able to say, mind your own business. In the Baskol, lo b'shamayim, the Torah is no longer in heaven, it's been given down on earth, and we must make our own decisions. Avraham Avinu was told to sacrifice his son Yitzchak in a situation where for years he'd been preaching the wrongness of doing that, and here he was instructed and commanded to go and do that. And the argument that goes on in his mind with the Yetzer Hara, that it can't mean that, and surely it means something else, and surely that's not the idea. And Avraham sticks to it. It looks wrong. It looks unbelievable. It's beyond understanding. But Tzivui Hashem, Ribono Shel Olam instructed me. Therefore, it becomes one of these axioms which cannot be questioned. No matter how great the questions are, I'm entitled to question, but not to doubt. That was the principle of last week's shiur. This week, we're going to go a little bit further, and we're going to discuss, how does one acquire that total confidence to be able to withstand the pressure of doubt and of self-doubt, and to be able to stand firm in one's opinions where that is necessary? And by the way, we're also going to answer another question which troubles a lot of people, and that is that so often so many people who are not frum and sometimes who are not even good people in a sense, certainly not in a Torah sense, are so nice as human beings. They mention, why is it so often that one finds people who have no shaychus to Torah whatever? On the contrary, very often they're apikursim, even very often they're atheists, they deny the Torah, and yet they're very special and fine people. That also needs to be understood and will be dealt with, by the way. A person's perception of the world comes from one of two sources generally. Either his perception comes from society, from convention. He sees the world the way people see it. His understanding of what is normal and what isn't normal is dictated by the way the world sees it. What the Ozum says, that's what decides what is normal and what isn't normal. What does one normally do? What does a young person normally do after school? Does he study? Does he work? How does one normally spend one's time? How does one normally spend one's money? All these things are fixed by convention, by the way what people normally do. There are situations where one can't fix it by convention, or where one doesn't fix it by convention, and then it's fixed by one's own common sense. One's constantly having to make decisions all day, and one sometimes not in areas on which there's any particular convention, and there one has to use one's own common sense. Those are the two areas or the two sources of information on which a person builds the decisions that he takes. He either makes his decisions on the basis of convention, or on the basis of his own das, of his own understanding. Seeing the world through the eyes of convention is terribly dangerous, because the same convention that makes you see it in a particular way, if that convention changes, will make you see it in another way. There cannot be constancy and there cannot be steadfastness when one's vision of the world is based on a perception that one has received from the society in which one lives. That cannot be constant. If I were to ask you which is your right hand and which is your left hand, everybody would know straight away, this is my right hand, this is my left hand. If I would say to you, how do you know? So everybody knows. It's convention, everybody knows, it's clear. The Torah says, the Gemara says, on the posuk, on the mitzvah, "Lo tosur mikol asher yerucho yomin u'smol," that one isn't permitted to deviate from everything that Chazal teach us, left or right, right or left. And the Chazal say that means afilu sheyemru al yemincha shu'smolcha v'asmolcha shu'yemin, even if they will say about your right hand that it is your left hand and your left hand that it is your right hand, that's how it's going to be. If the gedolim will come and they'll say, no, you're all putting tefillin on the wrong hand. We'll put it on the other hand. We'll say, no, you know, it says in the halacha you've got to put it on the left hand, and we're all right-handed people. And these Gedolei Yisrael would say, of course it says you must put it on your left hand. We're not arguing about the halacha, but don't you know which is your left hand? The other hand is the left hand. The din is we have to take our tefillin off and put them on the other hand. Even though we'll go outside and we'll ask any man in the street, which is my right hand? He'll say this. Which is my left hand? He'll say this. Still, I would have to put my tefillin on the other hand, because Chazal told me that's my left hand. What are we being told in this? That the knowledge of which is my left hand and which is my right hand does not come from convention. How do you know which is your left hand and which is your right hand? It's the wrong answer to say, but everybody knows. That's wrong. How do I know which is my left hand and which is my right hand? Because my father taught it to me. That's how I know. My teachers taught it to me. That's how I know. What's the nafkamina, you ask? What's the big difference? If I know, the fact is that I know it. What difference does it make where I learnt it? A big difference. If I learnt it in the street, then what will I do when the Rabbonim come along and they say, this is your left hand, not this one? I say, you've gone meshuggah. If I learnt it from my Rabbeim, if I learnt it from my teachers, when the Rabbonim come along and they change it around, I'll say, okay. And society will say, but you've gone mad, this is your left hand. I'll say, you meshuggah. You don't know. So there's a very big difference in terms of where does our knowledge come from. A simple thing like which is your left hand and which is your right hand, which normally we would think it's quite safe to ascribe such knowledge to society, to convention. On that specifically, Chazal say that that example is the one they pick. No. Even if they'll tell you that your right hand is your left and your left hand is your right, that's how you've got to act from that moment on. Time, and you've got to believe it, and you've got to act in that way. Because your source of knowledge of which is your right and which is your left hand is not convention. Your source of knowledge in that area is your Rabbeim. It's tradition, it's Mesoris, it's Kabbalah. These things are handed down from parent to child, from teacher to student. Even such little things as that are handed down. The Egel Azov, the golden calf. So as we discussed last week, the Bnei Israel look up and they see with prophecy, with prophetic vision, they see that Moshe is dead. Actually have a vision, they see him lying out dead, and there's this blackness in the world and this confusion in the world. And so they decide they have to make some form of a substitute for Moshe Rabbeinu. What's wrong with that? If you were the ones who elected Moshe Rabbeinu, then you're right. Moshe, the one you elected, is no more. You need to elect a replacement. But you didn't elect him. He elected you. The Ribbono Shel Olam gave him to you. And if you are now going to doubt his words, if you are going to believe that it is feasible that your own prophetic vision, as great a prophet as you might be, that your own prophetic vision could supersede something that Moshe said, then there's no more Torah. Exactly the same as if I'm going to believe that because the Rabbanim would tell me that my left hand is my right and my right hand is my left, if I'm going to believe that they're crazy, well, how did I know in the first place that this was my left hand? I knew because they told me. I knew because my father taught me. Now he's the one that says change around. So what am I going to say? No. Why not? The famous story where the person comes to Hillel to learn, and he says to Hillel, I want to learn only Torah Shebichtav, only the written law. I don't want to learn this oral law business, no Gemara, just the Torah Shebichtav. And you know how the story goes. Hillel teaches him, this is the okay, we start with Aleph Beis. The first letter of the alphabet is Taf, says Hillel. And the guy learns Taf. He says, the second letter of the alphabet is Shin. He learns Shin. Next one is Reish. Repeat it, it's Taf, Shin, Reish, excellent. It's the next one, it's Kuf. And so he goes backwards through the alphabet. The guy comes the next day and he says, say the alphabet for me. He says, Hillel, he says, Taf, Shin, Reish, Kuf. He says, Hillel, what's wrong with you? You're saying it backwards. Aleph, Beis, Gimel, Dalet. So the guy looks at him in amazement. He says, but yesterday you taught me Taf, Shin, Reish, Kuf. He says, Hillel, sure. So you see, in the end, you're in my hands. Even Aleph, Beis, you've got to believe me with. Where do you start if you're not going to believe me? So stop this nonsense of you only want the written law. You'll teach whatever you'll learn whatever I teach you. You can't pick and choose. The moment you're going to decide, this I'll accept, this I don't accept, that's not learning. If one comes, if it's the father that taught you that this is your right hand, if the father comes to you later on and says, hey, I made a mistake, change over. The other one's the right hand. So you change. Either whole of society does different. Everybody in the world does different. Doesn't matter. Where did I learn it from in the first place? Not from them. I learned it from my father. And as I was confident all the time that this was my left hand, so I continue to be confident that this is my left hand. Because he who taught me in the first place that this was the left, has now taught me that this is the left. Finished. And I don't worry about what the world thinks and does. Likewise, if we're going to say, Bnei Yisrael, you accepted the Torah. You were prepared to take every word from Moshe. If you're going to think that it's feasible, that any later prophecy could supersede one letter of what Moshe taught you, then you might as well close the Torah and become some other religious fanatic. Because there is no Torah if you believe that. There is no, after the first testament, there is no second, third, fourth or fifth testament. That's the end, it's closed book. There is no more Nevuah, no more prophecy that can undo the Torah. There will be prophecy. But no matter how great the prophecy, no matter how great the miracle, says the Torah, if there's one letter that's changed, that's false prophecy, we don't accept. And so now we have a situation where Bnei Israel look up and they see with their own prophecy. But imagine the power of that prophecy. 600,000 prophets all saw the same Nevuah. That never happens. You know, there have been prophets, all sorts of prophets, good ones, bad ones, kosher ones, treif ones, there have been all sorts of things in history. But it's always been one person that's seen and the other that's believed the story. to have a situation where 600,000 people see in prophecy, and there's no argument at all as to whether the vision took place or not. So can you imagine the power of numbers? How persuasive that is. How tremendously powerful that is in what it stands for. Everybody's talking about it. Everybody's crying. The whole society. Why? Moshe's dead. Moshe's dead. Not maybe Moshe's dead. Moshe's dead. The papers are full of it. The flags are down at half mast. The music is the slow old martial music being played. What are you going to say? I don't believe it. How are you going to say that? It's difficult to stand up to it. But they were expected to stand up to it. Because that same Moshe that you accepted, that there isn't a word that can be undone by anybody else's prophecy. So the prophecy of 600,000 is no greater. We talked a little bit earlier about quality. When you're talking about the quality of prophecy, it is not changed by the quantity of prophecy. 600,000 Nevi'im are not greater than one Navi. One Navi is infinite. 600,000 times infinite is also infinite. It doesn't make any difference. What we do know is that the prophecy of Moshe is unchangeable. What we do know is that no later prophecy can alter any letter there. So if you know that, what are you getting so upset about this prophecy that you're seeing? It's false, that's all. Likewise with Shaul. Shmuel says to Shaul, I appointed you king. You didn't appoint yourself king. You didn't appoint yourself king. The people didn't appoint you king. Who appointed you king? I did. If you doubt my prophecy, Shaul, you'd better abdicate. Because if you think that I might not be accurate, and when we come to emiskite, and when we come to accuracy, there's no such thing as 90% accuracy. Or 99% accuracy. You can't have a prophet who's 99% accurate. Because you'll never know which percent is inaccurate. So you'll always worry that maybe maybe in the area that you're concerned with is the percentage of inaccuracy. But you can't have such a thing. Therefore says Shmuel to Shaul, if you accept my prophecy, which obviously you do because you accepted the throne, why didn't you wait until I came? How did you interpret the fact that I wasn't there yet? What went through your mind, Shaul? Okay, you were standing there and the Plishtim were gathering and the army was coming together. Your army was breaking up and they were deserting you. You were being left with nothing. Every minute that you waited, your chances of winning the war were less and less. I understand that. But when you didn't listen to me, when you brought that sacrifice before I came, how did you interpret that? What did you think? After all, I said I was going to come. So you must have said in your mind, so he's made a mistake. He can't make it, he's late. Did you think maybe I made a mistake when I appointed you king? Then you didn't think maybe I made a mistake. Then you didn't think maybe it isn't genuine, maybe it isn't true. That you were happy to accept. He who you accepted to make you king has given you a further instruction. You either accepted all or nothing. There's no such thing as partial acceptance that you can't have. Certainly not with Nevuah. That's the whole concept of Kabbalah. That's the whole concept of receiving. Be careful who you receive from. Be careful who you listen to. Be careful who you read. Be careful who you study. But once you've chosen, you can't start choosing, this I'll accept, this I won't accept, this I will, this I won't. That's not how we learn, that's not how we study, and that's not how we grow. And that's not how we accept the words of a Navi. The words of a Navi you either accept or you don't. You can't pick and choose. When the source of our information is convention, then we're on very shaky ground. Because the moment convention changes, the moment convention puts pressure on us, we have to change with it. If Shaul's authority came from the nation, when the nation started to desert him, he would have been obligated to do just what he did and to disobey the Navi. But if Shaul's authority comes from the Navi, he can afford the luxury of ignoring society. He can afford the luxury of completely being unmoved and completely unshaken by anything that's happening around him. Can you imagine anything more frightening for a king, for an army general, than to stand against a tremendously powerful army, gathering strength every moment, when your own army is being depleted and when it's being deserted, and when you look around and there's a handful of old men and that's all you've got to fight? And if you wait for another 5 minutes, you won't even have them. Can you imagine anything more demoralizing for him? But if his authority doesn't come from them, from the people, he's fully happy to be able to go ahead and to do that which is right, and that's all that's important. we often find that there are very fine people who are religiously destructive, shall we say. People are very nice, they're mentioned, they're fine, they're good, but their attitudes, their hashkofas, their views are negative and destructive. And that's something which the Vilna Gaon says is part of the Bria. The Gros says in Mishle, on chapter Yud Aleph, Pasuk Tes, the Lochein, and therefore, Roiv Haminim, most apikursim, most agnostics and atheists, Toivim Beteva, are by their nature good people. An unbelievable statement. Most apikursim are by their nature Toivim, they're good people. He says that that's just part of the whole scheme to give them the power to dissuade us. Because if they weren't nice people, imagine how easy it would be. If all the frum people were nice and all the non-frum people were horrible, there wouldn't be much bechira. The whole bechira comes from the fact that we find so many frum people who are not exactly as we would have them, unfortunately, and we find so many atheists and agnostics who are very nice people. That places us in the dilemma which we need to sort out. But says the Vilna Gaon that Roiv Minim, most of the Apikursim, that means more than 50% of the Apikursim, Toivim and Beterva, are naturally good people. So what does it mean if you can be good without the Torah? What's the whole point? The answer is that the goodness of people whose source is not the Torah is from one of two areas. The one possibility is convention. They do that which is expected of them. They were brought up that way. They live in a society where you say please, where you say thank you, where you say good morning and you say good afternoon. They live in a society where you observe a certain standard of honesty and integrity. They live in a society where you dress like a mensch, where you live like a mensch, and so they're very menschlich. That's fine. What is the source of that religion? What is the source of that morality? And they say, we're moral people, we're moralists. We don't believe in the ritual of Judaism and all this business about God and all that. That we don't believe in. But the moral part we accept, we believe in that. Very good. Where does it come from? What is mechayev you? What obligates you to keep all this? Convention. And if the convention should change, and if you should suddenly find yourself living among people who regard it as square and old-fashioned to be honest, who regard it as square and old-fashioned to say please and thank you, what happens then? Then your whole morality breaks down. As we saw happening in Germany, where you had a nation of people steeped in culture and in politeness to the extreme. And what happened? So they killed the Jews politely. That's it. They tried to do it with finesse. They tried to do it efficiently. They tried to do it with as little mess as possible. Just managed to somehow get the productivity up as far as possible. Yeah. One could even imagine, although I don't think it was like that, but one could even imagine the German guard standing in front of the gas chamber and opening the door for the Jew. Please, please come inside. That's the way we're brought up. We open the doors for one another. We let other people in first. We're kind to one another. That's it. But do you murder one another? Well, it depends on the convention at this time. The norm is, yes, we murder, so we murder. There is nothing other than that that is obligating. And if one finds oneself living in that kind of society, that goes. One sees that very much in Israel today, and perhaps a little bit less today than one saw 10, 15, 20 years ago. Because in Israel 15 or 20 years ago, there wasn't much of a Western influence. What was there? What was Israel made up? The Americans were in America, the South Africans were in South Africa, and the English were in England. So who was in Israel? You had Moroccans, Algerians, and Yemenites. And you had some Jews from Eastern Europe. And the Jews from Eastern Europe were mainly the Apikursim that we're talking about. The Jews from Eastern Europe, there weren't that many of them that were religiously inclined. Most of them, in fact, were very anti-religious. And the Moroccans and Algerians and some that were brought out were soon stripped of their religious feeling. So what did you have left in there? What was the social norm of that society? Western standards weren't there, because that power, that influence didn't exist. Jewish standards weren't there, because the Eastern, the Jews from the Oriental countries had given it up, and the Jews from Lithuania had given it up. So that wasn't there, except in certain areas one found it, in certain basic Yiddish things that one can't give up, that are deep, deep down in every Jewish heart. There was still a lot of chesed, there was still all sorts of things that deep down were there. But apart from that, so what was there? An Arab influence. That was the social environment in which the country was operating. An Arab influence. And one looks today at the young Israelis who were brought up 10 and 15 years ago, who are today in their teens and their early 20s, and one sees the product of a generation brought up in an Arabic country. There's nothing Jewish about it at all. I'm talking about the non-religious Israeli who was not exposed either to Western Christian norms of values, nor to Jewish norms of values. He was brought up on some distant kibbutz somewhere where no contact with any such thing. No Jewish values, no Christian values. So what has he got? That part of the world, Arabic values, that's all that there are. And today there's the hooliganism, there's the lack of culture, there's the lack of refinement, the things which we've become to take so for granted. Because even if we don't see it among one another as Jews, we see it among one another as Westerners at least. There's that thing. One comes to Eretz Yisrael, and for a newcomer it's a terrible shock. Terrible shock. He either lives among people from the West, in which case he feels fairly comfortable, or he lives among frum Jews, in which case it takes a while for him to adjust. Or if he lives among ordinary non-religious Jews with non-religious backgrounds who have not had contact with the West, he finds himself in a completely alien society with values and systems of living that are very foreign to him. One has to sit on Dizengoff Street on a Saturday night, not on a Motzei Shabbos, isn't a Motzei Shabbos in Dizengoff Street, it's Saturday night, on Rehov Yafo in Jerusalem on a Saturday night, late on a Saturday night, after the discotheques come out. What does one see? That one sees the product of such a generation. Rov haminim v'apikrusim, most of the minim, says the Gro, were tovim b'teva, because they grow up at least with a system of norms. But when those norms change, when those norms are taken away, when they find themselves in a different society, or in a society that no longer respects those norms, gone are their norms as well. And their whole Torah, their whole religion, their whole morality disappears with the society round and about them. That's not the case with somebody whose moral values come from tradition. That's not the case, he says, when you say to him, why do you say good morning always? Why do you say good afternoon? Why do you say please? Why do you say thank you? And he doesn't say because everybody does. He says, because my father taught me. He says, that's what we have to do. My teachers taught me. My rabbein taught me. That's how you behave. So how's he going to be when he lands up in a funny culture? How's he going to be when he finds himself in Rehov Yafo on a Saturday night, or on Rehov Dizengoff in Tel Aviv on Saturday night? Is he going to stop saying good evening? Is he going to start throwing garinim on the ground because that's what they do? Never. But he's in that society, and in Rome do like the Romans do. No, that's not how I was taught in Rome, do as the Romans do. I was taught in Rome and Jerusalem, do as your parents do. That's what I was taught. And then you can have steadfastness. Why people stop and look at him like some kind of crazy meshugan? It doesn't matter. It's unimportant, because my values never came from you, and therefore I don't have to report to you, and I'm not responsible to you. You do what you want, and let me do what I want. My values come from my tradition. My values come from my roots and from my culture and from my background. That's where they come from. And I'm not obligated to adapt them to meet your crazy ideas. But you can only say that when the values do come from the roots and do come from that tradition. But there are so many situations in which we find ourselves where we haven't been taught anything by our parents to cover those situations. One's parents, nor any sforim, nor any teachers, can teach one every single situation that can arise in life. And we can get rules, we can get attitudes, we can get modes of behavior, we can get basic principles, but we're constantly having to make decisions for which we, in terms of training, are ill-equipped. Everybody is. There comes the second area of a source of perception of the world. That's das. A human being was given the ability to we'll define das as we go along. I don't want to call it common sense, although in a sense that's what it is. Common in the sense that it was that in theory, at least that in potential, every human being has it. In that sense, common sense. But it's more than common sense. We make a bracha every morning, and it's the first bracha that we make. Baruch Ato Hashem Elokeinu Melech Hayolam Asher Nosan Lasechvi Bino Lahavchin Ben Yoyim Ben Loyla. We thank the Ribbono Shel Olam for the Bino, the intelligence, to distinguish between day and between night. On Motzei Shabbos we say a special bracha in the Shmoneh Esrei, also thanking God for giving us the ability to discern between Kodesh and Chol, between Jew and Gentile, between day and night. And we put that in the bracha of Chaynein Hadas, in the bracha of the thanking the Rabbeinu Shalom for giving us Das, giving us knowledge. Perhaps the most essential and basic aspect of Das, of knowledge, is that, is the Koyach Havchono, is the ability to discern. But let's understand the nature of that bracha that we say every morning. We thank the Ribbono Shel Olam, we praise Him. Baruch Ato Hashem Elokeinu Melech Ha'olam Asher Nosan Lasech V'Bino, who's given us such intelligence. Now what do we expect to say? Such intelligence that we can understand the Tosfos. Such intelligence that we can conceive of the theory of relativity. Such intelligence that we can understand mathematics. Such intelligence, Ribbono Shel Olam, that we can distinguish between day and night. What does it mean? Do you need such intelligence to distinguish between day and night? Does one need to be so? Does one have to be so brilliant? Does one need to have to be so gifted and talented to distinguish between day and night? It's amazing that we don't stop and think about that bracha, because on the surface it doesn't make any sense. Distinguishing between day and night, no, you don't have to be a big chochem. To tell the difference between midday and midnight, you don't have to be a big chochem. But we use a specific phrase. We say, Asher Nosan LaSechvi. And Sechvi is a word which has a double meaning. It means the human being, and it also means a rooster, a cock. Asher Nosan LaSechvi Bino Lahavchin Ben Yom Vein Laila. Why this double meaning? Because there is a special dimension to the way a rooster is able to discern between day and night. He has a special gift that we don't have so simply. When the rooster starts crowing, we can't even notice that there's any change. It's only because the rooster crows that we know it's nearly daytime. Can you imagine what it used to be like in the days when there were no watches? And don't forget that sundials didn't used to work at night either. So how did you know when to get up? Your first indication that the night was drawing to an end was the roosters or the cocks. That's the first thing that you knew. And if you looked out of your window half a minute before the roosters started crowing, you wouldn't know whether it was 12 o'clock at night or 1 o'clock in the morning or 2 o'clock in the morning or 4 o'clock in the morning. You wouldn't know where it was. You have to wait until the roosters crow. And if you would look out of the window half a minute after the roosters have crowed, you still wouldn't notice a difference. That's what the bracha is. The ability to distinguish between day and night as clearly at 4 o'clock in the morning, when that's the time, as you can at midday and at midnight. To be able to see even in that grey area where day and night meet, to be able to see the boundary line with absolute clarity. That's a gift which the human being has. Asher nosan lasechvi bino lahavchin ben yom uvein laila. We can take things, there are many things that are so extremely different. Day and night, there's always the example that is given of something which is totally different. Black and white, day and night, people always say. But as different as day and night is, there's a point at which they meet where the distinguishing line is so fine that the human being is incapable of discerning under normal circumstances. It's the special intuition of the cock that can discern. A human being can't. Day and night are so miles apart. Yeah. At some times they're miles apart. And at some times they're very close. To tell the difference between a Jew and a Goy, Jew and a non-Jew. That was very easy when you used to live in Eastern Europe, particularly in some of the smaller towns of Lithuania. And in that particular part of the world, the non-Jews were by and large totally uneducated, very, very primitive, basic, very often cruel. Very, one can't imagine how basic the goyim of that area were at that time. And you go and compare him to one of the to a yeshiva bocher, to a rosh yeshiva, and you'll say, thank the Rebbe Hashem has given me the ability to perceive the difference between Jew and Gentile. Doesn't make any sense. You don't need any great gift to be able to tell that difference. But when you live in Eretz Yisrael and you come across a real fine non-Jew who comes from New York or from London, and he sits down at your table and you discuss matters, you discuss business, you discuss professions, you even discuss a bit of Torah with him, and then walks another fellow up to your table, short pants, sandals without socks, a blue kova tembel over his head, a shirt open down till his belly button, big huge muscles, and he walks down and he sits and he shovels the food into his mouth. Now go and tell the difference between a Jew and a goy. Now perceive that even in the strange Jew, even in this funny primitive fella, deep down there's a Yiddish and a Shoma, there's something there. He's still there. We still have to be able to perceive the difference and not to become over impressed with the goy. Because at the end of the day, the source of the non-Jew's beautiful behavior is convention. And if he finds himself among people who don't expect that from him, it won't take very long for it to disappear. The source of the Israeli Jew's little bit of behavior that he might have, it comes from inside himself. That's like when the cock crows, when there one has to use one's wisdom to be able to discern that there is a difference, and that the difference isn't necessarily in favor of the very respectable non-Jewish person. Not necessarily. But there is a kedusha and a neshama of the Jew, even if he's a long way off. This daya, this das, this ability to distinguish, is basic to normality. Because, as I gave an example recently in another shiur, what would happen if at 3 o'clock in the morning I ring on your doorbell and there's no answer, and I ring again a bit impatiently this time, and eventually you come in your pajamas and your gown, bleary eyed, and you open the door and you say, yes, what's the matter? And I said, what do you mean, what's the matter? I popped in for a cup of tea. Why are you looking at me so strange? You would probably politely serve a cup of tea while asking your husband and wife to phone a doctor, see what's the matter. And the next day you'll come and visit me at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I'll say, please don't disturb me. How can you walk into my house at 3 o'clock in the afternoon? This is time. Everybody's asleep now. This isn't the time to come visiting. Then you'll be sure there's something wrong. The man needs a doctor. What's wrong? He's unable to tell the difference between Yom and Laila. He's lost his ability to perceive the difference between Yom and Laila. And what about the man who, after the cock crows at 20 past 4 in the morning, is still lying in bed? Is he any more normal? It's daytime already. What are you lying in bed for? And if you would come and knock at his door at 4:30, he would also come bleary eyed. Now who's abnormal? Who's mad? He's mad. What are you still sleeping for? The cocks have crowed. It's morning. It's time to get busy already. But we don't see it that way. What time do we get up? We get up when Olam gets up. We are dictated to by convention, not by what is right. We're dictated to not by our own unique perception. We don't use our own common sense to decide what's right and what's wrong. We like monkeys. What everybody else does, that's what we do. People get up at 7, we get up at 7. People get up at 6, we get up at 6. Who gets up at 4? Then one doesn't do such a thing. 2 o'clock in the morning. Tomorrow morning at 2 o'clock, in a few hours' time, take a walk in Pretoria Street and Kotzer Street there in Hillbrow. It looks like the middle of the day. People walking around in the height of good spirits, making a noise. Sleeping time, it's not playing time. Who's mad? They mad or I'm mad? It depends how confident one is in one's own analysis of things. If we look at things conventionally, I'm mad. It's Saturday night. This is the time to play, the one time in the week when everybody does this kind of thing. What's wrong with you? Where do you come from? But if one looks at it, I'll be Torah. If one uses one's own common sense and one says, look, I don't understand the difference between Saturday night, Sunday night. I know it's night time. I know it's 2 o'clock in the morning. I know tomorrow is an ordinary day when one has to get up for davening, one has to learn, one has to work, one has things to do. This isn't the time to play around. Who's mad? Likewise, if a meshugana walks in through the door, let's say right now a meshugana walks in shouting and screaming and waving his hands and dribbling at the mouth, and we all treat him like a normal mensch. The shiur carries on, I don't say a word, and sort of wait for him to find a seat, which of course he has no intention of doing, and we treat him very respectfully, and we say a good voch to him, and would you like to come to Melava Malka and everything. Who's mad? We're mad, not him, because we're not relating to him. We haven't perceived that there's something wrong with him. We haven't perceived that he has a problem. We're the ones who have the problem even more so than he does. And likewise, if an ordinary normal human being came in and he walks in 5 minutes late for the shiur, and everybody looks at him and feels uncomfortable and starts shaking and smile at him and sneeze, well, you know, when you sit down, and don't worry, it'll be alright, and they start patting him and soothing him, and he's just an ordinary human being, he doesn't know what's hit him. And we say, well, last Mitzvah Shabbos at exactly the same time a madman came in. So we thought, who's going mad now? We have not perceived that the man is normal. We have not distinguished between a normal man and an abnormal man. Now those are examples I've given you between midnight and midday. But what about a person who comes in who's on the borderline of normality, but just a fraction over to the abnormal side, as opposed to another man who's on the borderline of normality, but just a fraction on the normality side? And the difference between them is fractional. There's hardly a difference between them. And we relate to them both the same way. Why? Because that ability that the rooster has to be able to perceive the difference even when it's close to each other, we don't have. Different people are different, and we treat everybody the same. That's part of our abnormality, that's part of our madness, that we're unable to relate to people. There are certain times that we do see differences. You can be quite sure that if Harry Oppenheimer wandered in through either door, it would be treated as if Mashiach came. Everybody would notice, everybody would be distracted from the shiur, everybody would start shuffling to make a seat for him. Chashivas. If an ordinary person came, it wouldn't be. So we do know how to distinguish a little bit. If a Gadol Yisrael walked in, everybody would stand up. An ordinary person walked in, nobody would stand up. We do know how to distinguish. But we only know how to distinguish when the differences are extreme. We only know how to distinguish between midnight and midday. The moment it comes to dusk and to shkia and to alos hashachar and neitzachama and these times of the day, we don't know the difference. We are unable to perceive. And that's the meaning of that brocha. We should know that we do have that ability, and we're expected to express that ability. No two people are the same, and therefore no two people should be treated the same. No two people are equally normal, and no two people are equally abnormal. No two people are equally righteous, and no two people are equally unrighteous. Everybody is different, and there needs to be discernment in the way we treat people. I've often mentioned to you that the Gedolei Yisrael, by the way they greet you, you know exactly who you are. You don't have to write any exams to know who you are. Just by the expression on their face, by the tone of their voice, by whether they do shake hands with you or they don't shake hands with you, they do stand up for you or they don't stand up for you, little things, and you know exactly, because they don't greet two people the same way. But one has to have one's eyes open to notice. In yeshiva, we used to just watch the Rosh Yeshivas saying good Shabbos to the boys in order for us to choose our chavrusas. And so we used to see, by the way, he said good Shabbos, we already knew who to keep away from. Just by the way, he said good Shabbos. Who to try and avoid sharing rooms with, who to try and avoid things. What is this das? We mentioned that it's a gift of the Ribbono Shel Olam, and it is so much so a gift of the Ribbono Shel Olam that, again, the Vilna Gaon says in Mishnah chapter Yud Dalet verse Yud Ches, he says that there are three partners to the human being: father, mother,
and the Ribbono Shel Olam. One inherits from parents Chochma and Bina, wisdom, knowledge in the normal sense, that one inherits from parents. They teach one, they pass it on. But the crown that one gets from the Ribbono Shel Olam is Shenosein Loi Deo Vahaska. The Ribbono Shel Olam gives us Deo Sheyeda Me'atzma, the ability to know something yourself without having been told it before. That's something inherent.
Now, Noam Chomsky did a lot of work in that area to try and find out how much of language creation is inborn in a human being. How much of it he's taught, and how much he would work out intuitively even if he was on a desert island. I'm not talking about vocabulary. We're talking about the grammatical rules that connect words together. And he claims, his whole theory is that there's a tremendous amount of it which is inborn, which the human being is born with. It's absolutely in it. And we see that there is such a concept, that while Chochma and Bina, the bulk of knowledge, information, you're not born with information. Information you have to be told. Which is your left hand and which is your right hand, somebody has to tell you. And you either pick it up from the street, or you pick it up at home from your teachers or your parents, who are supposed to be the same in principle. Information comes from one of two places, the street or teachers. But there's something else called knowledge. There's something else called understanding. There's something else called common sense, or what we're calling now the ability to discern. The ability to notice that A and B are different. The ability to notice that the rules that apply to A and the way one responds to A is not the way one responds to B. There must be a different response. That's something which the Ribbono Shel Olam gave us, Sheyeda Me'atzmo, that the human being has the capacity of knowing certain things from within himself. And when one uses one's das, it's as powerful as things that one has received from one's teachers and one's rabbi. Here again, what's going to change it? Convention? No. If I've worked this out, if I've perceived this myself, the fact that nobody else agrees with me, is that terribly important to me? No, it's not. The area for mistake, however, does exist. Let us take, for example, the spies. They came to Moshe Rabbeinu with a request that they want to send spies to spy out the land. Was there anything wrong in that request? So we established last week, no. But essentially there was nothing wrong with that. And in fact, later on, Yeshua did send spies himself. There was nothing really wrong with it, and the Ribbono Shel Olam would not have allowed it if it was inherently wrong. However, it turned out all wrong. And that turning out all wrong was to a degree predictable. Why? You're going to send spies. One of two things are going to happen. Either the spies are going to come back and say, oh, this is going to be a walkover, in which case you didn't have to send them in the first place. Or they're going to come back and they say, this is going to be a rough battle if we have any chance at all, in which case it's also negative. And what does it really depend on? The Gros says, again, we're going to go on Mishle chapter 10 Zion this time, in verse Beis. Kol darchei ha'odom, all the ways of a human being, nimshochim achar harotzoin harishoin, are attracted by his first desire. The first thing you want to do, that has tremendous power and tremendous weight in deciding what to do and what not to do. Uchamoy she'oyle aruchoi berotzoin harishoin, and what comes into his spirit at the first desire. And these are zochim v'yeshorim be'enof, are pure and straight in his own eyes. Don't tell a man who's fallen in love that he happens to have fallen in love with the wrong girl. That's like talking to the wall. There's absolutely no, one doesn't have a chance. The first impression, the first desire, is something which has tremendous weight. And in his eyes, Zochim v'yishorim, it's pure and it's straight. V'af she'oseh ovel, and even if he's doing wrong, even if he's doing something crooked, hu mareh ponim she'elech b'derech hayosho, he'll find ways of justifying that he's actually going straight. Kiloma,
Kivan she'incho yodea derech hatov. Since therefore you don't know which is the straight way. If we have that principle that one's ways are dictated by one's first desires, and one's first desires one will defend no matter what, how do we ever know that we're doing right? Lachen ein lecho lismoich klal al seichel ho'enoshi. And therefore one is not permitted to rely at all on human intellect. I'll explain that in a moment. It needs to be understood. But you must check that your actions are in accordance with the will of Hashem. There's a little sefer called the Evin Shlemo, which is a collection of some of the Vilna Gaon's statements. And it's a very reliable collection. And in this, he quotes this in Evin Shlemo as well. And in brackets, he explains there that what it means is not that you mustn't rely on human intellect at all. Obviously, that doesn't make any sense. But that when you want to do something and you've taken a decision based on human intellect, he says, search carefully as to what it was that initially motivated that first desire. Was it something self-centered, or was it the Ritzon Hashem? Search carefully and strain it through, purify it and check. Go right to the origins of the motivation and check at the basis, at the foundation of the motivation. What's there? That needs to be checked. Thus, one's own seichel, one's own knowledge, one's own common sense, one's ability to discern is all very well, and it's something internal. And because it's internal, it has tremendous power. We stand by what we understand internally. The danger is, though, that it is based on a desire which itself might not be 100% straight. If Bnei Yisrael wanted to send spies 100% only because they believed that was the right thing to do, and then what would happen? Could anything go wrong? If they would see that the land is really easy to conquer, they would come back and say it's easy to conquer. What would they say if they came back having seen that the land was difficult to conquer? They would come back and say this is going to be difficult, but the Ribbono Shel Olam has done enough miracles for us already, and we've got him on our side, and with the Ribbono Shel Olam on our side we'll manage. But if there's something wrong in the original motivation, if there's something a little bit possible, a little bit treif in that original motivation, do you realize how wrong it can go? The same action, but there's nothing inherently wrong in the action, it's in the end of the action. If you think it through to the end, there could be trouble if the origin is a little bit off center. And how are we going to check if the origin is off center? You remember last week we learned that they came to Moshe Rabbeinu Be'irbuvia, shoving around, the children pushing the older people, the stupid people pushing the clever people, the young ones pushing the senior ones. It was nirbuvia. At that point already it was possible to perceive that this is on to the wrong start. Why? There's the famous story that Reb Chaim Volozhiner came to the Vilna Gaon with a wonderful idea. He conceived of the concept of yeshivas. At that stage there weren't yeshivas in the modern sense. An organized yeshiva where a staff is put together, a faculty is put together, and a building is taken, and there's lodgings are secured, and there's a dining room arranged, and people sit in one building and come from all over the country to this one central place and learn. That concept wasn't there. And he thought of this idea, and he thought of what a wonderful thing it could be for Torah. And he went to the Vilna Gaon and he gave him the plans and the idea and how he wanted to do it and where he wanted to do it. And the girl said, no, not a good idea. He went away very dejected. Many years later, he was sitting again with his Rebbe, the Vilna Gaon, and he said, you know, Rebbe, he said, I must again remind you about that idea I once had, which I still think was a good idea. We were going to start a yeshiva, and this is what it was going to be, and he describes it again to the girl. And the girl says, so what are you waiting for? You do it, of course you should do it. And he says, but excuse me, Vilna Gaon, he says, but when I put it to you the first time, look how many years I've lost. You told me not to do it. Oh, he says, the first time you were too excited about it. Now you're talking in a settled tone. Why? We're only excited about the things that we believe are the real things. When Bnei Yisrael came Be'irbuvia, the little ones pushing the older ones, the junior ones pushing the senior ones, young people pushing the more advanced people, everybody in a rush. Why was that? Because they were so excited about the idea. Let's send spies. What's so exciting about the idea? Because you believe that with that way we have a better chance. That's the psul, that's where you've gone wrong. Is that what you believe? You're excited because it's important. You're excited because you think the salvation lies in this. And therefore, what's going to happen if you find that the land is too strong for you? Of course you're going to be shattered after having put all your hopes and all your trust in this action. That not. Had they come to him in a quiet and settled fashion and said, you know, Moshe, we know that the country will be conquered by us because the Ribono Shel Olam has promised us. We know there will be miracles. But shouldn't we do as much as one is able to do physically? We shouldn't rely only on miracles. Maybe we should at least go through the motions of doing it naturally. The way one earns a living, the way we do all the other miraculous things that we do every day. We at least go through the motions of making it appear normal. Let's send spies. That way nothing could have gone wrong. But there was irbuvia, there was excitement. And where there's excitement, one has to be suspicious. Because one is only excited when one thinks one's doing it oneself. We don't get excited about other people's accomplishments. We don't get excited about the Ribono Shel Olam's accomplishments. We get excited about our own accomplishments. In the early decades of the century, the Tzel Zhirov used to speak about this in relation to the Zionist movement. And he said at that time, there's nothing wrong with the Zionist movement. On the contrary, it's a big mitzvah, there's no question, to go and be Miyashev Eretz Yisrael. But they're too excited about it. They don't shake Lulav and Esrog like that. They don't keep Shabbos like that. They don't keep Kashrus like that. They don't build mikvahs like that. Why this mitzvah are they so excited about? That with Mesiras Nefesh they are prepared to give their lives to sacrifice all their possessions for it. What is it? That's not Elishem Shemayim. For Elishem Shemayim there's quietness, there's a settled attitude, it's done with thought and it's done because it's the right thing, with a great deal of consideration and a great deal of kovid rosh, of seriousness of intent. One doesn't jump into the fire that easily. Religious fanaticism, like any other fanaticism, is emotional. And something which is only emotional has its netziah, has its roots in the rotzein ha'odom, in a man's own desires. That's why he does it, for whatever reason. And that's not something we're terribly impressed about. No form of religious fanaticism, no form of fanaticism. The thing is done because it's right, okay, but then it must be done carefully and it must be done with yishuv, it has to be done properly. Avraham Avinu is busy walking up to the mountain about to sacrifice his son. And all these arguments go through his mind, how maybe he misunderstood God. Surely God couldn't have meant that. And the Yetzer Hara is standing there and arguing with him. No, you shouldn't. This is not what you're meant to do. Your whole life you've given to teaching that this is not what you're meant to do. And there must have been a moment where Avraham might have thought to himself, maybe there's something in it. And how would he have dispelled it? He would have said, now, one second, why do I think there's something in it? Because I love my son. That's the sign. There's nothing to be taken too seriously. A desire which has an emotion as its origin is a desire of which one has to be very suspicious. It doesn't mean it's necessarily wrong, but one has to be very suspicious of it. Nor does it mean that there mustn't be emotion in our practice. There must be emotion, but the emotion comes later. One doesn't fall in love and then get married, because the chances are that one's getting married to the wrong girl. It's highly unlikely, unless one really does believe in miracles, it's highly unlikely that one's going to fall in love with the right girl. That would be absolutely coincidental. There it goes, people. It's so funny, people argue about against the old Shadchan system. What kind of a system is that? Some old lady puts a boy and a girl together. What does she know about them? Yeah, but to meet a girl at a party and fall in love with her at sight, and that's when the decision is made up, basically, because from there everything just flows. That's chokhmah. That's done with wisdom and with planning and with knowledge and with understanding. It's ridiculous. It's crazy. It doesn't work that way at all. One gets married to the right girl and then one falls in love. It's a different process, and it takes a long time, and it's a lifelong process. Is there emotion? Of course there's emotion. There's deep emotion. But in a frum marriage, the emotions that exist and the passions that exist after 10 years of marriage are greater than the passions that existed on the honeymoon. In a non-religious marriage, and I'm talking religious not in the formally religious, but in terms of the concepts that we're discussing,
there is no greater passion than at the Panim, and from there on it's one long downhill slide. That's the difference. There are things that start off with a burst of passion and they peter out, and there are things that start off with wisdom, with thought, with understanding, with planning, and the passion builds up and builds up and builds up because it's so right, because it's so correct, because it's so nice. That's the way it has to be. What have we said? That the human being's source of perception of the world, and consequently his response to the world, is based either on convention, on what everybody else does. He picks it up from the street, or he picks it up from his teachers, or he works it out with his own common sense, with his own das. If he picks his perception up from the street, he is very, very open to the influence of the street, and his perception will change as the fashions change, and as his social milieu changes, and as the situation in which he finds himself changes. He will constantly finding his own perception of the world changing together with it. If he picks it up from his teachers, there is no change. That stays, unless his teachers tell him to change, that stays and that remains. If he perceives something with his own das, if after very careful analysis and understanding, he's used his ability of discernment to notice that two things are different, that one has to relate to this situation different to the way one has to relate to that situation, and that's something he's worked out himself, there again he is confident and he can have steadfastness of mind. Again, unless he's shown by wise people, by his teachers, that he's making a mistake in his das, the mere fact that other people do differently, the mere fact that other people have not perceived these subtle distinctions, that doesn't throw him off balance at all. He is sufficiently confident in his own das, because das is inborn, das is something deep inside oneself. He knows it intuitively and instinctively to be right, quite apart from the fact that he's worked it out. That doesn't mean that he can't make a mistake. On the contrary, when a thing is made up, when one works a thing out oneself, one is constantly subject to the tremendous danger that one is using one's mind to justify a preconceived desire, and one isn't really analyzing from scratch. And that preconceived desire may or may not be a true one. It may or may not be kosher. It needs analysis. And to analyze that, says the Gro, we have to go right back to the origin of that motivation and that desire, and to see, was there irbuvia there? Was there confusion there? Was there too much excitement? Because things about which one is too emotional and too excited at the inception are usually not right and are usually not correct. The excitement comes later. The place for the excitement is not at the inception. The Zionist movement was criticized by the Brisker, by the Telzerol, for being too excited at the beginning. But Chaim Volozhiner was criticized by the Vilna Gaon for being too excited at the beginning. Excitement comes later on, not at the very outset. We've unfortunately only touched on the subject, and I think that we still have to take it further next week, even before we go on to the next aspect of this whole subject, which is, why are there inborn influences in the world to try and dissuade one off course? Why are there such pressures? And we'll show you that it's not just the masses and so on, that the Ribbono Shel Olam actually created pressures in the world to try and convince people that they're making a mistake when they're not really. To make people insecure about their own beliefs. To make people doubt their own conclusions and their own principles. There is such a power, such a force in the creation that God actually put there for certain reasons. And we'll still analyze that, but that will be at least in 2 weeks' time. So that next week in Yirtzeh Hashem, I'm going to summarize and clarify what we've done tonight, because tonight was very, very difficult. I had to cover a certain amount of ground in order to complete the picture, and then to take it a little bit further and understand how it is that one develops sufficient clarity of mind to be able to stand by one's principles whenever one needs to, amid whatever pressures one has to, and yet also have sufficient suppleness to be able to adapt them to situations and to be able to change them when necessary. That balancing line we'll still have to discuss. Hmm?
the Purim Seudah, please, ladies and gentlemen, if you have to attend the shir and arrange for